Welcome to Create Your Bliss with Nika Annan, and today we have the wonderful opportunity of talking to Mauro Zapatera. Mauro Zapatera graduated from Harvard Medical School with an MA, with MD and PhD, and now specializes in physical medicine and rehabilitation with a particular focus on regenerative medicine, neurorehabilitation, neuroplasticity, musculoskeletal medicine, and pain. He completed his PhD doing work with neuronal stem cells and the effects of the cerebrospinal fluid, CSF, in brain development and in the adult. He has published in numerous scientific articles on the CSF, and his work was chosen as the cover image for the prestigious Neuron Journal. He combines his training in rehabilitation medicine, research, nutrition, and various complementary and alternative medicine modalities, such as polarity therapy, cranial sacral therapy, to work holistically with individuals to optimize their potential and improve their quality of life. I first heard Mauro at the Science and Non-Duality Conference, and he gave an amazing talk on cerebral spinal fluid, and I would like to introduce to you now Mauro Zapatera. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is very exciting, and I would love to just dive in and start talking about cerebral spinal fluid, maybe with what it is and what we know and what we can hypothesize about it.
Yeah, I think those are all great questions, and it's great that just bringing awareness, I think, to this fluid. You know, the first fact is that there is a crystal clear fluid in the middle of our brain. This fluid essentially is contained in the cavities of the brain called the ventricles. And it bathes, it not only is bathing the inside of the brain in these ventricles, but it's also bathing all the outside surface of the brain. It goes down, we have a central canal in our spinal cord, and it goes all the way down the spinal cord. And we also have something called the dural sac, and that essentially is on the outside of the spinal cord. And this fluid goes all the way down the outside of the spinal cord, and it goes to about your sacrum level 2 or 3. So it goes pretty far down. You know, you're sort of sitting on a bag of cerebrospinal fluid, let's say. So just to bring that sort of understanding to people that we have there's a crystal clear fluid in the middle of our brain that's circulating throughout our brain, that's bathing the inside of our brain, that's bathing the outside of our brain, that's bathing the inside, the actual central canal of our spinal cord, and also the outside of our spinal cord. That to me is just is pretty incredible. You make about 500 milliliters of cerebrospinal fluid a day. So if you think of a half liter water bottle, essentially,
wow,
that's how much of it you make a day. You know, it's a pretty significant amount of fluid that you're constantly generating, that's constantly flowing through you. And at any point in time, you have 150 milliliters of cerebrospinal fluid in you. So that would be equivalent of, let's say, a third of that water bottle is actually in you at any time, which I think is pretty, you know, I think is pretty remarkable in terms of the amount of cerebrospinal fluid. The other really interesting thing is looking at the ventricles. So the ventricles are these cavities. They're actually these cavities in the brain, okay, that are filled with fluid.
Okay.
All right. And we have we have what they call four ventricles. One is two of them are the lateral ventricles, which essentially, if you can imagine, they're sort of contained within our cerebral hemispheres. So the right and the left, what people would kind of think of the brain. Okay. Then there's a connection with the lateral ventricles to the third ventricle. And the third ventricle is a midline structure, sort of right behind what people would consider their third eye, right behind the middle of their brow region. Mm-hmm. about equidistant between the ears, between the points, the highest point of the ears, so equidistant to the middle, right behind the brow region. That's the third ventricle. And then there's a little tube. It's called the cerebral aqueduct, and it connects the third ventricle to the fourth ventricle. And then from there, it goes around the brain and down the spinal cord as well. Well, if you look at the structure and the actual anatomy of the ventricles, it's absolutely fascinating. It looks almost as if the third ventricle was like the body of a bird, and the lateral ventricles were the wings.
Oh, wow.
Okay? And the fourth ventricle were sort of its feet. Okay, if that makes sense. So if you can imagine,
right.
Yeah, so if you can imagine this bird sort of, you know, this bird with the body would be the third ventricle, and its wings are spanning the both of the left and right cerebral cortex, and then it sort of has these, like, you know, these sort of feet kind of appendages going into the fourth ventricle. Well, what's amazing, if you can imagine these wings, okay, so let's look at the lateral ventricles just in of itself. And these are just, you know, these are simply like details that I've sort of collected over time that I've thought is really, you know, incredible. If you look at the lateral ventricles themselves, they go all the way from the frontal lobe, so sort of the most frontal part of your brain, back into the occipital lobe, or back into the parietal lobe, which is kind of the middle area, back into the occipital lobe, okay, which is the posterior area of the brain, and then it sends a little projection. It looks like a little tributary out, and it connects, and it actually makes contact with the visual center of the brain as well. Okay,
wow.
Then it keeps on going down, and it goes into the temporal lobe. Okay, so imagine this ventricle that goes all the way. It sort of just like encircles the entire the entire cortex. It has to make contact with all those parts of the brain. Okay. Which,
so somehow it's connected to everything in there.
So, yeah. So you said that. Why would this ventricle want to be connected to every lobe of our brain? You know, that has this fluid. Like,
what would the purpose of that be?
What would the purpose of that be? Right. So, looking at the sort of the structure of how we're created, because you know, anytime you study sort of the, I think. Anytime I've studied the body or been in the lab, there's always been this incredible awe with how nature has created and has evolved certain things. If we look at the ventricles and the system of the brain, it's the exact same thing. Let's look at that and see, does it actually give us any understanding of what are the possible functions of this fluid in the brain? Okay. The other cool part is the third ventricle. The third ventricle is that midline structure right in the brain, right behind the brow that I was talking about. And this actually makes contact with both the pineal gland and the pituitary gland,
which are essential to functionality.
These are huge in functionality. You know, just looking at the science again, there's a lot of science that's being done by various people. One is that I presented Dr. Russell Reiter. He's at UT Health Science Center. And there's a lot of people speculating. The pineal gland, one of its important functions is actually the production of melatonin. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
There's sort of been this thing. Melatonin is a very, very interesting compound because it's considered a hormone, but as we start studying it, its roles are just, it's evolving. You know, we're understanding it as a molecule that not only, you know, people typically think of it as regulating the sleep-wake cycle. So when the light outside goes down, our eyes actually perceive the dimming light, and then the pineal gland is receiving that information and is starting to synthesize melatonin and release melatonin. That melatonin actually helps us fall asleep, which is why, you know, you can actually go to the store and buy melatonin and take it. And in many people, it actually helps them fall asleep. But it also does a number of different other things that we're understanding and learning. A lot of different rhythmic, processes of rhythmic variations in the body, such as like body temperature and appetite. But it's also a very powerful antioxidant and a detoxification molecule. So the more we're learning about this, the more it's actually expanding as what its roles actually are. And I don't actually think we fully understand what the potency of this compound actually is. But there has been some interesting sort of research going back and forth looking at, once the pineal gland creates melatonin, how does it distribute it to the rest of the brain? Okay?
Uh-huh.
Because it's got to be distributed to the various centers and, you know, induce a quality of sleep. Okay? And so there's various researchers, Dr. Reiter, one of them, who published a very interesting paper on this, looking at the release of melatonin from the pineal gland directly into the CSF. And then using the CSF as a vehicle of transportation, essentially this fluid vehicle of transportation to the entire brain. Okay? So if you imagine, if you kind of have this picture of this fluid not only bathing almost every single important sort of major regulatory center within the brain from inside out, but also bathing the entire brain from the outside in, that actually a very good mechanism of transmitting information, so whether that's melatonin released from the pineal gland or a growth factor that's released from a certain area of the brain that needs to, you know, spark some stem cell proliferation and differentiation, that the CSF being a fluid, you could actually distribute something throughout that fluid to the entire central nervous system just by dropping it into the CSF and having the CSF sort of distribute it for you to all the different areas of the brain. So
if it's a fluid, it may dilute while it's in there, right? So that it doesn't have to go about how quickly it could be disseminated
exactly.
Across the body.
Exactly. So it gets sent in there, it gets put into the fluid, and then it can actually disperse quite rapidly. And yeah, there is definitely a dilution factor to it, but there's also the pineal gland continues to produce it. So it's also, there's also, you know, continuous sort of supply as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you look at the fluid, that fluid could actually be a vehicle for transmission of information to the entire brain. There's no synapses that have to happen for the fluid to transport a molecule to different parts of the brain. And it can sort of, you know, it can sort of imagine, like I sort of see it as like, you know, try, like if you want to, you know, have you ever put like a drop of red coloring dye in some water and then watched it kind of disperse?
Mm-hmm. And swirl and make all those beautiful patterns.
Exactly.
The whole thing. Right.
Exactly. So, you know, imagine almost like the pineal gland, like dropping a little bit of like red dye and then slowly you see it disperse and then slowly the entire, you know, the entire water is red. You know, the entire fluid is red. And so looking at all the areas that the cerebrospinal is contacting, it makes sense that melatonin, for instance, would be released by the pineal gland. It goes into the cerebrospinal fluid. The cerebrospinal fluid then acts as a vehicle of transmission to the entire brain so that you can have what I call kind of like a holistic experience, and that would be a shift in consciousness. You start to kind of feel sleepy, and you start to fall asleep, right, as the light kind of dims more and more and more, and then you fall asleep, and you're in this state of sleep. Okay? When they've actually looked at the concentration, this is a beautiful study actually done way back in 1977, actually, when they looked at that, and it was published in the journal Science, which is, you know, one of the pristine journals in science. The CSF concentration of melatonin goes up by 17 times compared to 6 times in the blood. So there's a huge amount of melatonin that's just deposited into the CSF. And the time that it's deposited, they studied this for 24 hours. And the time that it's actually deposited, it starts, the increases in concentration occur around 7 p.m.
Uh-huh.
And they stay around till around 6 a.m. So you sort of start seeing this peak around 7 a.m. At about 8 p.m., you're almost getting to the peak, but 9 p.m., you're at the peak. Okay, so if you can imagine kind of the daylight, you know,
right,
diminishing,
right.
You're right, you're starting to produce melatonin, it starts to increase, and then it kind of stays. And it kind of stays at that peak level until about 5 or 5:30 a.m. in the morning. And then it starts to decrease. And so, you know, so that's where you may. So this pineal gland is just constantly kind of producing the melatonin, distributing it into the CSF. The CSF is transmitting it throughout the brain and continuously kind of giving us this global experience of sleep. Okay. So that's just one example of the CSF being a transmitter of information, whatever that information is. Here I'm using the example of melatonin as an inducer of sleep. Okay. In all of our studies, what we looked at was we actually looked at the cerebrospinal fluid during embryologic development, and what we found was that there were crucial proteins in the cerebrospinal fluid that changed with time in the embryo, and those proteins and those growth factors, hormones, there was a lot of different things that we found, and that those proteins were actually pretty important for regulating how the stem cells proliferated, you know, how much they proliferated, whether or not the stem cells would differentiate. So a stem cell is, you know, a stem cell is essentially a cell that is multipotent, which means that it can become a different variety of cells. Okay,
right.
So a stem cell, we're looking at, you know, a stem cell can become like, it can become a heart cell, or it can become a liver cell, or it can become a neuron, let's say. Okay. In the brain, there's specific stem cells. And interestingly, what we found is in the embryo, first of all the stem cells are making contact with the cerebrospinal fluid. Okay.
Wow.
And, yeah. So as you're developing, all your stem cells are making contact with the cerebrospinal fluid. Early on in development, before the stem cells even kind of become stem cells, that area of our body is actually what would be analogous to the amniotic fluid. So I'm going back, like, you know, I'm talking like maybe like 10 days in development, like, you know, 10 days post-conception sort of thing.
Right, right. It's
very, 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 very beginning. Yeah, yeah. So the amniotic fluid becomes the cerebrospinal fluid. The cerebrospinal fluid is bathing all the neural stem cells. So every single cell of your central nervous system is at one point either bathed by amniotic fluid or cerebrospinal fluid. And then as we grow and develop and the brain develops, the brain starts undergoing differentiation and growth, and those stem cells essentially differentiate and they move away from the CSF and they start creating, you know, the brain and the rest of the organ essentially. And what we found was that there was a number of molecules that were deposited into the CSF, and they changed. They were very dynamic during embryologic development. So there were certain peaks, for instance, we found one protein that, like, at day 17 in a rat embryo would just peak and then it would disappear. It was like, wow, what is that protein doing right at that day 17? What is happening? And we actually noticed that it was almost like a little bit of a peak in the number of proliferative stem cells that we found at that time, and then it would disappear.
Huh.
So
it's probably tied to the developmental cycle.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, the more we kind of looked at it and studied it, the more we actually thought that this was a very, very powerful fluid for distributing molecules, growth factors, hormones to the entire brain simultaneously. You know, it's like something kind of similar to melatonin. If you needed something to happen to the brain on a global, you know, if you're going to imagine a global developmental perspective, mm-hmm. it makes perfect sense to just put something into the CSF, allow the CSF to distribute it to all the cells that are making contact with it, and then those cells can react to the molecule or to the compound or the growth factor that's in the cerebrospinal fluid. So we published a paper. We published it in Neuron, and we designed the cover image based on our vision of this, and it's essentially this. You know, from the embryo to a young adult to an older adult, you know, we kind of have this blue sort of streaming continuum of CSF, because there's sort of this continuum of proteins that are always present, but then the blue changes. It goes from we sort of depict this pictorially, but it's a blue that changes in intensity of colors, and showing that, you know, there's change throughout the time, our time cycles, depending on what we need at what point in our development. But there's this continuum of fluid that's constantly bathing our brains throughout, you know, early on in development. So just what we concluded from our research was essentially that the CSF provided essential survival and growth factors to the embryonic and adult brain, and that it was sort of a fluid niche for neural stem cells.
Wow.
So there's something about the cerebrospinal fluid that provides a niche for these neural stem cells. And when you look at, you know, when you look at even an adult, there's a lot of neural stem cells when you look in the adult brain that are making contact. They send like a little foot, and they send it, and they're making contact with the cerebrospinal fluid with a little structure called a cilia, which would be similar to kind of like an antenna,
mm-hmm.
sort of monitoring the fluid. And people are starting to understand that these cilia have receptors on them. They're constantly monitoring the fluid for things like, you know, what state is brain in, kind of thing. Do we need to develop and become a neuron, or go to a certain area of the brain to repair it? You know, things like that. And this is just sort of coming out, so it's not very, very clear yet. But the other roles, essentially, that of the cerebrospinal fluid, it transports nutrients and hormones. It, like I talked about melatonin, it regulates the circadian rhythms. There's actually research that has shown that it regulates appetite as well. So factors within the CSF actually help us determine if we're hungry or not. It can provide, based on how the flow of the cerebrospinal fluid is moving, it actually provides cues to how cells should migrate, which is, you know, that's like another
wow.
huge topic just by itself. Like I talked about the stem cells, you know, it instructs the stem cells to proliferate or differentiate. It also eliminates waste. There's some more research coming out that actually shows that the fluid isn't just present in these ventricles that I'm talking about, but
mm-hmm.
during states of sleep or altered states of consciousness, the fluid actually, the brain sort of, in a way, the brain tissue kind of shrinks or creates space, and
mm-hmm.
the fluid actually travels through the brain, kind of picking up waste molecules from the brain and bringing them back and just recycling them and bringing them into the blood, and that's new research that just came out in terms of like why sleep may be so important to us, because it might actually be an important factor in sort of creating more space in the brain, allowing the CSF to sort of flow through the brain tissue, almost collecting waste, and then, you know, it's a fluid, so it provides buoyancy and shock absorption to the brain. So that's just in a nutshell, you know, what what the cerebrospinal fluid does. And as people look at it more, it's interesting because there are some people out there that are, for instance, becoming very interested in this compound called DMT, which is
right.
Exactly. Dimethyltryptamine. So similar to melatonin, which is also produced from tryptophan, DMT is also produced from tryptophan, and you know, people are trying to figure out, you know, what does it do? And the reason why people and where is it present, you know, where is it located? Like and the reason why people are starting to, you know, is because first of all, it's present in many of the plants that are used for shamanic healing rituals. It's used, This is one of those sort of the premier compounds that's found in these plants. So it's widespread in the plant kingdom. And there's only small amounts of it in mammals in the animal kingdom that we know of today.
That we know how to find or recognize.
Exactly. And the person who's really done the majority of this work in terms of on humans is Dr. Rick Strassman, who actually published a book called The Spirit Molecule. And it's unclear still what it does. They're trying to figure out, they think it might actually have an immunologic role. I just saw a paper recently that it actually provides a boost in the immune system when it's released. But essentially, people who take it, you know, in his book, he actually published a book called The Spirit Molecule, and people who take it have... you know, described, first of all, it's a very powerful psychedelic. They've described numerous sort of near-death experiences and also mystical experiences.
Right.
Terence McKenna, who's a researcher also in these areas, he believed that DMT was a portal to another dimension where we gained access to the true nature of reality. So, you know, that's just a pretty interesting thought, you know,
that opens up some really interesting questions about how do we define our reality and how do we limit what we perceive.
Exactly.
That's a large portion of what our brain actually does, is help us edit, because there's so much information.
Exactly. You know, that's a huge, totally, filters. Some people hypothesize that it's released in our systems during birth. During vivid dreams and at death. So you'd say, okay, why?
So that would
you know,
be
these
like
are
near death experiences would be, I think he talks about tying those together, that there is.
Yeah, exactly. So, so we still don't know much about this, but when people looked at where is it present in the human body, what we found so far is that it's present in the blood at a certain concentration, okay? It's present in the urine. They've also found it in feces. It's present in the kidney and in the lung. Okay, and so they're trying to figure out, you know, why would this what is it doing? What's its biological role exactly?
Right.
But it's also found in the cerebrospinal fluid, and and in the cerebrospinal fluid, when they look, they found it in a number of people, six people they found it. And if you can imagine, you're looking for a compound that you're not really sure when it's present, right? So when do you actually do the study to take the CSF out to see if there's DMT in it? That's one of the, you know, that's one of the difficult parts of doing this sort of research is, you know, if you don't take the fluid out when the molecule is in there, then
you don't see it.
Do you say that the molecule is not there, or do you say, well, at that time it's not there, you know? And so therefore, when are you actually taking out the fluid? So I'm actually really surprised and shocked that they found it, but they found it in some of the largest concentrations of any other body tissue or anything like that. So, for instance, in the lung, it's present at 14 nanograms per kilogram,
mm-hmm.
but in the CSF, it's present. So the lowest amount in the CSF that was found was 350 nanograms per
wow.
liter. So, yeah, so, and it's, you know, the highest concentration that's ever found in the human is actually in the CSF at 100,000 nanograms per liter, where, for instance, the largest concentration that's found in the blood was 10,000 nanograms per liter. So that's a tenfold difference in the CSF than in the blood that's been found. Now, somebody could say, well, that's, you know, that's experimental error, that's just a matter of when you're, you know, when you're taking out the fluid,
right.
Exactly, when you're testing it, sample bias, all that kind of stuff. But what Rick Strassman, what his research actually just showed in 2013 was they took a pineal gland and they looked for DMT in the pineal gland and they found it.
Oh, wow.
So could the pineal gland be synthesizing the DMT that is released into the CSF for whatever those, you know, during times of lucid dreaming? Or, you know, do you have a large amount of it during those near-death experiences that people have experienced? Could it be, you know, like Terrence McKenna said, that through that release that there's some access to a true nature of reality, for instance? And I don't know. These are questions that are sort of, you know, these are questions that sort of pop up from this. You know, why would the DMT be in the CSF? So it's very interesting because if you sort of make the same analogy as I did with the melatonin with DMT, it would be, you know, if it's during vivid dream, for instance, while you sleep, while you might be, you know, in a certain state of consciousness, again, the pineal gland could release it. Similarly to how I explained the melatonin release, it releases it into the CSF. The CSF then transmits it to the entire brain, and you get a whole, you get a unified sort of holistic experience because the CSF is being used as a vehicle of transmission for that DMT to the entire nervous system. If that makes sense.
That's really one, yeah, because then it's present everywhere and you start having another, I don't know if experience is the right word, but openness to another piece of experience.
Right, right. So there's this sort of question, you know, there's this question that's always been, it's like, well, where, you know, where in the brain, you know, is there this experience of even the sense of our own existence, for instance?
Right.
You know, that experience of your awareness prior to a thought. And what I'm proposing is essentially that the CSF, being a fluid, could actually transmit that experience holistically to the entire brain, without it being actually in the brain, but actually in the fluid, transmitting it through the entire brain, both from the inside out and the outside in, to be able to sort of give that holism presence, as opposed to saying, okay, it's in the amygdala or it's in the cingulate gyrus or something like that. It could actually be the total connection of all of them through the transmission via the cerebrospinal fluid acting on all of them simultaneously. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. So if that was a possibility, say if we were to take that as a given, what would be the implications of that? How would that affect how we perceive the world? I mean, how could we begin to work with it, or how would you tie it to some of the practical things that you do? I know this is the really exciting research, and then I know you also actually work with individuals.
Yeah, well, first of all, I think just first of all, bringing awareness, I think just one of my, if you would say, mission is just to bring awareness, is just bringing awareness to the fluid. You know, that simply in and of itself is I believe, is actually powerful. So just bringing some awareness to the fact that we have a crystal clear fluid within our brain. Okay. So that's,
that communicates to all parts of our brain simultaneously.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's pretty
okay.
amazing.
That's number one. Exactly. That's it. Like if that's just what you get across, then that's, I think, beautiful. The other one is, you know, what you said was, is that it can be used as a vehicle of transmission for whether you want to use melatonin or, you know, DMT or any growth factor, for instance. That, you know, so those two are just, that's sort of, I think that would be enough.
that vehicle, right. From
the other thing, the other thing would be to, once you bring the awareness, once people sort of bring the awareness to the fluid, then sensing for themselves what qualities does that fluid have for them. You know, what kind of rhythm, what kind of pulsation does it have? As soon as you bring awareness to that fluid, what is your experience of that? What is your experience of the fluid? What do you feel like the fluid is doing for you?
So can you give me an example of how you would experience that or how you would bring awareness to it?
Absolutely.
That would be cool.
Yeah, but before I do that, I really would like to make it, I really would like to state that it's about the experience of the individual. It's about
Correct.
Their own experience. It's about people experiencing it for themselves, because that then becomes authentic for them. You know what I mean?
Correct.
It's not,
so you're not,
it's not
trying to script their experience.
I am not. No, exactly.
Yeah.
It's and for them to be, to remain focused on their experience, you know, that's essentially what's authentic. So if I say you have this fluid in your brain, bring awareness into the fluid that's within your brain. You know, that's, some people just with that, it's all of a sudden they feel a different, there's a certain different vibration that they feel, because they've always been sort of focusing on the brain, you know.
Right.
The sort of tissues, and I'm saying no, bring it to the fluid. So, within the brain, without the brain, that's in center, you're sort of your whole central nervous system is floating in this fluid, and it's being bathed by this fluid. You know. So just that, for instance. So what we do is we do certain just. Guided visualizations or so essentially all I say is,
do you want to do one? Are they quick? Do you want to do one?
I could, yeah, sure.
Okay. Let's do one.
Okay.
Because I think it's so important for people then to internalize it and realize that this is not foreign. You know, it is.
No, it's not. And we have, you know, we have this crystal, we have this fluid in our brain. And, you know, the everybody's implications from the, what everybody takes from it, it's like, wow, you know, like, there's so many experiences where I felt this bubbling, you know, I felt this fluid kind of, I didn't know what it was. And, you know, after the SANS talk, for instance, a lot of people came and they just thanked me, because it was like, it was like giving validity to their experience of them feeling this fluid nature and not, like a tissue or a cell, you know what I mean?
Yes, and not like sequential, synaptic, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly, and a lot of people, you know, in Kundalini yoga, for instance, talk about this bubbling from the sacrum, and this fluid quality that sort of rises from the sacrum. Well, the dural sac goes all the way down to sacral level too. You know, I always ask, like, why doesn't the dural sac end at at the spinal cord level, which is lumbar two. You know, it continues going down. So if this fluid has an energetic quality to it, if there's a certain pulsation, if there's a certain sort of biorhythm to it, that it's getting from, you know, that's present within it, then, you know, could they actually be feeling a certain energetic component that's rising within the cerebrospinal fluid? You know, and then this energy is actually bathing their entire nervous system, bathing their entire brain. You know, so it's coming from the sacrum, and it's sort of bubbling up and going. And that's a perfect example of something that could, you know, a vibration, for instance, that's present in the fluid that's emanating from the sacrum, from something that, you know, from something they did, and then it goes to the to their brain, and then it gives them this holistic experience of whatever that was for them, but that it's bathing their entire central nervous system in that. So, yeah, we'll definitely do one. So, okay. Usually I have people take a moment and just getting comfortable.
Okay.
In your chair. You can close your eyes. Feel your back and legs on a chair and your feet on the ground. And you can bring your attention to the middle of your brain, imagining a straight line from between your ears, and go to the center of that line into your third ventricle. This is a fluid-filled space in the middle of your brain, a radiant lake. A lake full of cerebrospinal fluid. Just sense the sensation of this radiant fluid. Is there a sense of pulsation? Is there a rhythm? Just sense the fluid throughout the entirety of the inside of your brain, around your brain, and all the way down the center of your spinal cord, and around your entire spinal cord, down to the tailbone. Just sense the pulsation, sense the fluid. Now return to your third ventricle, the radiant lake of CSF at the center of your brain. At the very back of this lake is your pineal gland, a pine cone-shaped structure. Just like you create gentle waves in a bathtub, create some waves that gently hit your pineal gland to activate it. feel the pineal gland being activated by the waves in the CSF. Continue to sense the fluid . Feel the total synchronization of energy that is present within you. Continue to sense the radiant fluid within you. Now, coming back, taking a moment to feel your feet on the ground. Your back making contact with the chair. And opening your eyes when you feel ready. Orienting back to your surroundings. The room, the light in the room, and the sounds in the room. So that would be an example of just a quick visualization.
Well, and of contacting it, because I found that to acknowledge that that's what it was and to tune into it, it deepens that experience. You know, when you suddenly realize that, yes, there is that sense of fluidity in there, and it made me realize that I occasionally will have these experiences where I'm speaking to someone and something happens and suddenly there's like a flush and the world gets this gold haze. I don't really know how to talk about it, but it's like it's suddenly that the perspective has very much changed.
It
just seemed to me that that was tied to acknowledging the cerebral spinal fluid in my body, that it was like, yeah, that's what I'm talking to you with.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that's my personal, that would be my personal belief of it.
Yeah.
Would be that there's some, you know, at that moment, there was something that shifted. And, you know, if the fluid, it really is just this perfect vehicle of transmission of information. And so that, you know, that's it, is having people have their own experiences of it, just bringing awareness to it and having people have their own experience of it. And that's, you know, that's actually the simplicity of it, I think.
Yeah,
and then from there, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I think, you know, from there, sort of the number of different possibilities, I think, open up in terms of, you know, what else could be transmitted through this fluid? Is there something else that could be transmitted through this fluid, you know? I think what this does is, you know, I think this just opens up a number of possible inquiries into, you know, what other information, what other energy could the CSF actually transmit or store, you know, whether it's certain type of vibrations, certain energies. This sort of opens up, I think, a whole new world of exploration and inquiry, which I think is really, you know, really incredible.
So what would be two different extremes for you? What would be the most practical application you could think of to proceed with your research, and what would be the most far out one?
The most practical would be, and people are starting to do this already, would be that we start tapping into the cerebrospinal fluid as a mechanism of better delivery of compounds, whether that's nutraceuticals, you know, or food, or good, you know, good medicine, let's say, the brain. And, you know, there's a couple people looking at, for instance, intranasal administration of compounds, because when we inhale things, we actually can go through the cribriform plate, which is a sort of a bony structure where the olfactory bulb, where the olfactory, the smell neurons come out of.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually is a direct route to the cerebrospinal fluid.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So maybe that's why smell is so primal for us.
That's a, yes. Yep. And, you know, they're looking at what are the different compounds that get into the cerebrospinal fluid through the intranasal route, and how can we actually get them to that? Because if we can actually get them to the cerebrospinal fluid, sort of taking advantage of all the principles I said of, you know, then this molecule being able to diffuse to all areas, all these different areas of the brain, what better way of kind of trying to get a molecule? Because a lot of the molecules that we use for the brain have to cross the blood-brain barrier. But if we have a different mechanism of actually getting them to the brain from the cerebrospinal fluid, I think, you know, that would be very practical, and I know people are looking at that as well. The other thing that people are starting to look at is, we didn't talk much about it, but the choroid plexus is a very vascular structure that creates the cerebrospinal fluid. And so people are trying to actually manipulate the choroid plexus to be able to release certain factors into the cerebrospinal fluid for therapeutic purposes. So those are all kind of, you know, very, very, very practical things about the cerebrospinal fluid. And, you know, a lot of people are kind of trying to look at it from a therapeutic, you know, potential. How can we get things to the majority areas of the brain that could possibly be healing? The more,
right.
Yeah, the more, let's say, esoteric would be, could this fluid actually be sort of the step down of the differentiated energy to the physical being? So, is there a certain energy that differentiates from, you know, the totality of source energy and differentiates to our physical bodies? So how do we manifest as physical bodies from the unified total source energy? You know, we're not separate from it.
Right.
We are it. But my analogy would be kind of similar to like a wave spectrum, you know, like a color spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Like infrared waves, they're not different than the energy is not different than the red, green, blue, purple that we could see, but we can't see it because it's in a different sort of energy spectrum. It's in a different wavelength.
Right.
Is there a certain
physical mechanism doesn't perceive? Yeah.
Exactly. It doesn't change, but it just there's a certain shift in the waveform that creates the visible light spectrum. So, is there a shift in the waveform that creates our physical beingness? And how does that energy manifest into our physical bodies? And so, you know, kind of out there would be that the first area, like, you know, if you're going from infrared to red, there's that part where, like, can't see the infrared, and then all of a sudden you see the red, you know. So in that same analogy, from our, let's say, our etheric bodies, which some people say they can see, to the physical body, could the cerebrospinal fluid be the first differentiation into physical form that occurs, that then the energy gets dispersed to our, you know, our bones and our cells and everything like that? That's a little bit more out there, but it would follow, you know, a concept of the chakra system sort of being, you know, ether, air, fire, water, earth. It goes from a more etheric quality, the ether, with a higher wavelength to a lower wavelength of earth, right? And you can almost, just by those words, the physical properties are condensing. They are becoming more hard, let's say.
Right. So
could the energy then shift in form and essentially step into the cerebrospinal fluid, which then steps into the rest of our being? And I'm working with a couple people in terms of, you know, trying to figure out, are there ways of actually trying to prove that? And that's a challenge. You know, there's a lot of theories, but then, you know, showing a mechanism or showing proof of that will obviously be the challenging part.
How does that happen? But that's quite fascinating. And when you talk about the amniotic fluid and that it is this that turns into the cerebrospinal fluid,
yeah,
and that all the stem cells talk to it, there's something going on there.
Yes, exactly. So early on in development, you're actually, your entire embryo is almost bathed in amniotic fluid.
Right. Right.
And so if you want to get even kind of, you know, I've been trying to look at this, but the facts are a little bit more iffy on this, but some people say that, you know, I've heard some people say, like, the soul comes into the body at 49 days. I still couldn't find, like, where that is.
You're right. Yeah.
You know, but, you know, kind of miraculously, that's almost when the cerebrospinal fluid completely differentiates from the amniotic fluid. It's also when, in the embryo of a human, the choroid plexus is really developed and starting to develop. You can start seeing it quite a bit at 49 days,
which
is the choroid plexus is what creates the cerebrospinal fluid.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I was just kind of piecing these things together, being like, okay, that's a little bit, you know, that's a little bit far-fetched. But, yeah, absolutely. Your amniotic fluid, like the fluid that you're bathed in your mother, okay, is, like, that same energetic quality, that same energy is present in your cerebrospinal fluid. So it becomes the cerebrospinal fluid in the embryo, and then it starts to differentiate. You kind of start taking on the cerebrospinal fluid, and then the amniotic fluid is bathing you from the outside. But initially, your entire central nervous system, when it's open and open to the outside, that's all amniotic fluid that's essentially bathing all of you. And, you know, that's pretty cool in and of itself. The other interesting part is, you know, and I still don't really know what to make of this, but it's interesting. People have the third ventricle which is that area in the middle of the brain that's contained, you know, with CSF. People have, that Taoists have called that the crystal palace. Some Hindu yogic traditions have actually called that the cave of Brahma.
Right.
And that's that area between the pituitary gland and the pineal gland. And there's some theorists out there that say, you know, the pineal gland is feminine in quality. You know, it's night. If you think of when the pineal gland is most active, it's actually at night, and, you know, with melatonin and all that. And the pituitary gland is more masculine in quality. And when the energies of the pineal gland and the pituitary meet, you have the perfect marriage, and it's called the mystical marriage.
Ah.
And that energy would meet in a neutral spot. That neutral spot would be in the fluid between the two, between these two very powerful, you know, glands.
Right.
In the third ventricle, which people have called, you know, the crystal palace or the cave of Brahma. So, you know, just like that, it's like, okay, anatomically, what have people called this place? Oh, the cave of Brahma. Why?
Right. What goes on there? And how
what goes
we...
on there?
Right.
Like, so that, you know, those are kind of things that you know we're keeping note of, and you know, especially presenting to this population, because it's really this integration of scientists and mystics and theologians and philosophers that I think are really going to expand and create new visions of the world. And that's why I think conferences like, you know, Science and Non-Duality are wonderful, because they're bringing people like, you know, Rudy Tanzi and Adyashanti together.
To talk, you know, and start talking about what is, instead of being so separated, to say what, you know, we're all talking about experience. Here's all of us feeling different parts of the elephant. What is it that we're feeling?
Exactly, exactly.
You know, how do we know, and how can we trust, how do we incorporate our current systemic form of knowledge with the old knowledge? Because
exactly, and we all have something to give based on our personal experiences, and we all have something to receive from everybody else's knowledge, you know, and personal experiences, and that's the beauty of, you know, when you can actually share in that sort of, and I think it makes everybody's work better. You know, the more work I did on spiritual understanding, it was like the more it actually helped inform my science. The more that I bring, you know, the more that people bring anatomy, even just anatomy and physiology, to healers, the more that informs their the sort of physical realm of what they're doing. You know, and so I've seen that blend work so well, and it's like, oh wow, like I'm feeling, you know, like I'll have certain healers tell me like, I'm feeling that difference between the fascia and the muscle,
right?
You know, but I never knew. But I didn't know words, and now all of a sudden it's like they're given a vocabulary, and then their work actually gets better.
Right, because they're including all levels of knowing, and how can that not empower us? How can that
exactly
not give us more awareness and subtlety to be
exactly,
you know, and accuracy. So no, it's very exciting. And this has been our wonderful conversation today on Create Your Bliss. We have been talking with Mauro Zapatera about the cerebral spinal fluid. Thank you so much for speaking to us. This is fascinating, and I'd love to have you back on the show to continue following where this leads. Please tune in 2 weeks to listen to Create Your Bliss, and you can find it at www.nikaannon.com. That's NIKAANNON.com. Thank you so much. And again, thanks to our wonderful guest, Mauro Zapatera.